Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. This is Epilogue 2, Chapter 9. Oh, and by the way, yesterday I accidentally messed it up and I read the discussion for Chapter 9 when I was meant to read the discussion for Chapter 8. But it didn't seem to make any difference. So I think the topic of this chapter is a continuation of yesterday's one, because all the discussion about Chapter 9 was about free will. So I think that's why I didn't even notice that I was reading the wrong chapter's comments, so we can expect here a continuation from yesterday. Epilogue 2, Chapter 9. For the solution of the question of free will or inevitability, history has this advantage over other branches of knowledge in which the question is dealt with. That for history this question does not refer to the essence of man's free will, but to its manifestation in the part and under certain conditions. In regard to this question, history stands to the other sciences as experimental science stands to abstract science. The subject for history is not man's will itself, but our presentation of it. And so, for history, the insoluble mystery presented by the incompatibility of free will and inevitability does not exist as it does for theology, ethics, and philosophy. History surveys a presentation of man's life in which the union of those two contradictions has already taken place. In actual life, each historic event, each human action, is very clearly and definitely understood without any sense of contradiction, although each event presents itself as partly free and partly compulsory. To solve the question of how freedom and necessity are combined, and what constitutes the essence of these two conceptions, the philosophy of history can and should follow a path contrary to that taken by other sciences. Instead of first defining the conceptions of freedom and inevitability in themselves, and then ranging the phenomena of life under those definitions, history should deduce a definition of the conception of freedom and inevitability themselves from the immense quantity of phenomena of which it is cognizant, and that always appear dependent on those two elements. Whatever presentation of the activity of many men or of an individual we may consider, we always regard it as the result partly of man's free will and partly of the law of inevitability. Whether we speak of the migration of the peoples and the incursions of the barbarians, or of the decrees of Napoleon III, or of someone's action an hour ago in choosing one direction out of several for his walk, we are unconscious of any contradiction. The degree of freedom and inevitability governing the actions of these people is clearly defined for us. Our conception of the degree of freedom often varies according to differences in the point of view from which we regard the event, but every human action appears to us as a certain combination of freedom and inevitability. In every action we examine, we see a certain measure of freedom and a certain measure of inevitability. And always, the more freedom we see in any action, the less inevitability do we perceive, and the more inevitability, the less freedom. The proportion of freedom to inevitability decreases and increases according to the point of view from which the action is regarded, but their relation is always one of inverse proportion. A sinking man who clutches at another and drowns him, or a hungry mother exhausted by feeding her baby who steals some food, or a man trained to discipline who, on duty at the word of command, kills a defenseless man, seem less guilty. That is, less free and more subject to the law of necessity. No one who knows the circumstances in which these people are placed, and more free to one who does not know that the man was himself drowning, that the mother was hungry, that the soldier was in the ranks, and so on. Similarly, a man who committed a murder 20 years ago and has since lived peaceably and harmlessly in society seems less guilty, and his action more due to the law of inevitability to someone who considers his action after 20 years have elapsed than to one who examined it the day after it was committed. And in the same way, every action of an insane, intoxicated, or highly excited man appears less free and more inevitable to one who knows the mental condition of him who committed the action, and seems more free and less inevitable to one who does not know it. In all these cases, the conception of freedom is increased or diminished, and the conception of compulsion is correspondingly decreased or increased, according to the point of view from which the action is regarded, so that the greater the conception of necessity, the smaller the conception of freedom, and vice versa. Religion, the common sense of mankind, the science of jurisprudence, the history itself, understand alike, and history itself understand alike this relation between necessity and freedom. All cases without exception in which our conception of freedom and necessity is increased and diminished depend on three considerations. 1. The relation to the external world of the man who commits the deeds. 2. His relation to time. And 3. His relation to the causes leading to the action. 1. The first consideration is the clearness of our perception of the man's relation to the external world, and the greater or lesser clearness of our understanding of the definite position occupied by the man in relation to everything coexisting with him. This is what makes it evident that a drowning man is less free and more subject to necessity than one standing on dry ground, and that makes the actions of a man closely connected with others in a thickly populated district, or of one bound by family, official, or business duties, seem certainly less free and more subject to necessity than those of a man living in solitude and seclusion. If we consider a man alone, apart from his relation to everything around him, each action of his seems to us free. But if we see his relation to anything around him, if we see his connection with anything whatever, with a man who speaks to him, a book he reads, the work on which he is engaged, even with the air he breathes, or the light that falls on the things around him, we see that each of these circumstances has an influence on him and controls at least some side of his activity. And the more we perceive of these influences, the more our conception of his freedom diminishes, and the more our conception of the necessity that weighs on him increases. The second consideration is the more or less evident time relation of the man to the world, and the clearness of our perception of the place the man's action occupies in time. That is the ground which makes the fall of the first man, resulting in the production of the human race, appear evidently less free than a man's entry into marriage today. It is the reason why the life and activity of people who lived centuries ago, and are connected with me in time, cannot seem to me as free as the life of a contemporary, the consequences of which are still unknown to me. The degree of our conception of freedom or inevitability depends in this respect on the greater or lesser lapse of time between the performance of the action and our judgment of it. If I examine an act I performed a moment ago in approximately the same circumstances as those I am in now, my action appears to me undoubtedly free. But if I examine an act performed a month ago, then being in different circumstances, I cannot help recognizing that if that act had not been committed, much that resulted from it, good, agreeable, and even essential, would not have taken place. If I reflect on an action still more remote, 10 years ago or more, then the consequences of my action are still plainer to me, and I find it hard to imagine that what would have happened had that action not been performed. The further back I go in memory, or what is the same thing, the further I go forward in my judgment, the more doubtful becomes my belief in the freedom of my action. In history we find a very similar progress in conviction concerning the part played by free will in the general affairs of humanity. A contemporary event seems to us to be indubitably the doing of all the known participants, but with a more remote event we already see its inevitable results, which prevent our considering anything else possible. And the further we go back in examining events, the less arbitrary do they appear. The Austro-Prussian War The footnote says the Austro-Prussian War of 1866 occurred while Tolstoy was writing this novel. Appears to us undoubtedly the result of the crafty conduct of Bismarck, and so on. Wait, this is happening after the event. This is happening 50 years after the events of the novel. Anyway, but in the Crusades, we already see an event occupying its definite place in history, and without which we cannot imagine the modern history of Europe. Though to the chroniclers of the Crusades, that event appeared as merely due to the will of certain people. In regard to the migration of the peoples, it does not enter anyone's head today to suppose that the renovation of the European world depended on Attila's caprice. The farther back in history the objects of our observation lies, the more doubtful does the free will of those concerned in the event become, and the more manifest the law inevitably. The third consideration is the degree to which we apprehend that endless chain of causation inevitably demanded by reason, in which each phenomenon comprehended, and therefore man's every action, must have its definite place as a result of what has gone before and a cause of what will follow. The better we are acquainted with the physiological, psychological, and historical laws deduced by observation and by which man is controlled, and the more correctly we perceive the physiological, psychological, and historic causes of the action, and the simpler the action we are observing, and the less complex the character and mind of the man in question, the more subject to inevitability, and the less free do our actions and those of others appear. When we do not at all understand the cause of an action, whether a crime, a good action, or even one that is simply non-moral, we ascribe a greater amount of freedom to it. In the case of a crime, we most urgently demand the punishment for such an act. In the case of a virtuous act, we rate its merit most highly. In an indifferent case, we recognize in it more individuality, originality, and independence. But if even one of the innumerable causes of the act is known to us, we recognize a certain element of necessity and are less insistent on punishment for the crime, or the acknowledgement of the merit of the virtuous act, or the freedom of the apparently original action. That a criminal was reared among malefactors mitigates his fault in our eyes. The self-sacrifice of a father or a mother, or self-sacrifice with the possibility of a reward, is more comprehensible than gratuitous self-sacrifice, and therefore seems less deserving of sympathy and less the result of free will. The founder of a sect or a party or an inventor impresses us less when we know how or by what the way was prepared for his activity. If we have a large range of examples, if our observation is constantly directed to seeking the correlation of cause and effect in people's actions, their actions appear to us more under compulsion and less free, the more correctly we connect the effects with the causes. If we examined simple actions and had a vast number of such actions under observation, our conception of their inevitability would be still greater. The dishonest conduct of the son of a dishonest father, the misconduct of a woman who had fallen into bad company, a drunkard's relapse into drunkenness, and so on, are actions that seem to us less free the better we understand their cause. If the man whose actions we are considering is on a very low stage of mental development, like a child, a madman, or a simpleton, then knowing the causes of the act and the simplicity of the character and intelligence in question, we see so large an element of necessity and so little free will that as soon as we know the cause prompting the action, we can foretell the result. On these three considerations alone is based the conception of irresponsibility for crimes and the extenuating circumstances admitted by all legislative codes. The responsibility appears greater or less according to our greater or lesser knowledge of the circumstances in which the man was placed whose action is being judged, and according to the greater or lesser interval of time between the commission of the action and its investigation, and according to the greater or lesser understanding of the causes that led to the action. All right, there we go, another chapter down. That was some of the worst book I've ever read. That was shocking. Tolstoy, it's like he wants you to disengage at this point. Reading the start of this, I was starting to think, like, this is actually, like, separate from the novel. Like, this is departed from our characters entirely, right? Which I kind of knew already, but, like entirely. Like, a lot of the rants and stuff in the book had this weird and kind of effective thing where it was almost like a random character from the book was talking to you. I had that feeling. I don't know if that anyone else had that, but like the narrator was like a random observer from within the scene or from within the world of the novel. And his rant, like, it was like Tolstoy wasn't necessarily the narrator. Like, the narrator wasn't Tolstoy's voice. It was just a vessel through which Tolstoy ranted. And even these last chapters of Epilogue 2, I kind of thought he was still writing from the perspective of the novel's setting, the time of the novel, where it's set, that place in history. Even though he was talking about historians a lot, he kind of had it acknowledged that it was 50 or 60 years after the events of the novel. But now, in this chapter, he started referencing things that happened in the 1860s, acknowledging that he's writing this from post that time, from 50 years after the event of the novel, which kind of just completely acknowledges the fact that this is separate from the novel. Like, it was a complete departure from the rest of the novel for me. And before we referenced 1866, an event of 1866, I was already having the feeling like, suddenly, it just came upon me, this chapter. Like, he's not even in the novel anymore. This is just like an author's note. It's not part of the book. It's, like, an epilogue is meant to still be part of the book, is my point. But this isn't an epilogue anymore. This is just an author's note. And it's awful. It's truly awful. I've come this far and, I don't like it. I like if I'm picking up a book, right, a story, I want to read a story. Okay? This is not a story anymore. This is, I want to say, like, it's not even educational because it's just a rant of someone. It's just someone's rant. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I would recommend to people not to read the second epilogue because it's just too, he's just taking too many liberties, I think. An author's note at the end would have been fine, and it could have been a couple of thousand words worth of author's note. But this 12 chapter long thing disguised as an epilogue, it's bad. It's bad. Oh, gosh. Anyway, let's go into, well, we already read the comments for this chapter in yesterday's one. I apologize if you can hear thumping and stuff in the background. It is a Saturday night. Apparently my neighbors are having a bit of a party. Maybe we should read the comments from yesterday's chapter, seeing as we read the today's ones yesterday. Here's a funny comment from yesterday. De Fleury said, "I'm getting caught up. Tolstoy. Without believing in free will, man cannot live. Also Tolstoy. Hey readers, here's proof you don't have any free will. Conclusion, I'm not paranoid. Tolstoy actually is trying to kill me in this epilogue." Disgruntled upvoter said, "No, it's boredom and confusion that will kill you. Oh my God. I don't think I could write sentences as long as these if my life depended on it." It's bad writing. I mean, this is supposedly one of the best books of all time, but I want to know if there's anyone who actually defends the writing in this epilogue. Like, is there any merit to be found in this? Or is it just the rants of an angry old man? Wait, he wasn't even old at this point, was he? How old was he when he wrote this? Let's actually find that out. War and Peace. I've always got this image of him being old, right? Being an old man. As he wrote this book. So it was written in 1867. He was born in 1828, so he was 39, right? He was only 39, okay. He was a fairly young man when he wrote War and Peace. All right. Tone change. I need to change my tone here. This chapter left a bad taste in my mouth, but we are 3 chapters away from the end. 3 chapters, and we're going to move on to Stephen Crane, two of Stephen Crane's short stories, which will take us a couple of weeks to get through. Each of those has about 8 or 9 chapters, I think. And those are going to be quite fast-paced and exciting. We're going to have lots of new listeners come the start of the year. So that's exciting too. Big things are coming. I am excited. All right, I'm going to check out because this chapter's annoyed me. And also, it sounds like my neighbor is just maybe hitting... It's 2 a.m. in the morning right now. And I think my... I don't know why I've stayed up so late. My neighbor seems to be just screaming and hitting something with something else. Like, it just sounds like he's out there, like, maybe kicking a wooden fence. You hear that? Yeah. All right. I'm going to check out. Oh, there's some screaming too. I am going to end the episode here. I'm going to go outside and see what the hell is going on outside in my street. If I'm not back tomorrow, it's because my neighbors have killed me. I do not know what they're doing out there at 2 in the morning, screaming and thumping. But it sounds like a hell of a lot of fun. Wish me luck. All right, bad episode. I apologize for this episode. This might be the worst one. This might be the worst episode. It's only partly my fault, though, because this was also one of the worst chapters in the book. So you can also blame old Leo, Uncle Leo. All right, thanks for listening. My apologies for the crappiness of today's episode. You guys are fantastic, beautiful, wonderful, and patient people. And I will see you tomorrow.